The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP. Annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Kevin Richard.
Welcome to the City Club's biggest event of the year, our Political Pundits Forum and Snarkathon. So I want to start by thanking today's forum sponsors, and we have five of them. ACLU of Idaho, Boise State University's School of Public Service, the Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine, Kestrel West, and Micron. I also want to thank our media sponsors, Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, and Peppershock Media. We couldn't put on these events without your support, so thank you. Now, today we have 564 of you here, and you look like a lot of people. And it's exciting to see you all, and it's a little bit scary to see you all. But welcome, one and all. I want to give a special welcome to the 60 students from Boise High School who are with us today, accompanied by, go Braves, accompanied by Monica Church and Trevor Roper. We also have 10 students from Capital High School. I'm a Capital dad, so go Eagles, accompanied by Cindy Wilson. I'm really glad that we have some of tomorrow's politicos and pundits here today, so welcome to you. To give us some much-needed perspective from beyond Boise, we have Bill Spence, who is the political writer with the Lewiston Tribune. And I just wonder aloud how many times I'm going to have to begin a question by saying, "Hey, Bill, that's one of your legislators, right?" All right, moving right along. In the center, we have Melissa Davlin. She is the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. She also blogs at the Idaho Reports website. She is the co-host as well of the Point of Personal Privilege podcast. Now, Melissa's short-term career goal is to moderate a series of televised debates this spring and have none of them go viral. Good luck.
If there are any gubernatorial candidates here today, I would really appreciate your help with that.
Again, good luck. Last but certainly not least is Betsy Russell. She is the political reporter for the Spokane Spokesman Review, and she is the tireless author of the must-read Eye on Boise blog. And she's also one of those Berkeley graduates you may have read about recently. Get this away. Okay. All right, so folks, we're 3 weeks into this session. And I wanted to pose kind of an introductory question that you can take in a lot of different directions, but do not answer this in one word, or else we're going to have a terrible start to this forum. 3 weeks in, if you had to sum up the session in one word, what would it be?
Well, I'll start. So my word is circular. And the reason that I selected circular is because thus far this session, it has been very, very busy. Boy, has it been busy. But we haven't really gone that far. In some ways, it's reminiscent of a hamster on a wheel. So circular, that's my word.
I chose gloomy for a number of obvious reasons. You know, we had a pretty rough start to the legislative session with the death of Brandon Hickson and then the subsequent release of details surrounding not only his death, but the pending investigation around accusations against him. We had sexual harassment orientation. We had tensions with the respective parties bubbling forward and making things really, really tense around the State House in general. And we've also had a lot of tension between the media and elected officials. And that's always been there, and sometimes that kind of tension is healthy, but this year it's become a little bit more apparent. I've often wondered what would happen if the legislative session wasn't held during January and February when we're all suffering from seasonal affective disorder, and we're all, you know, post-holidays, we're already depressed, we already hate our lives, and then they throw us into this building all together. But I take hope, and the day is getting longer and sunnier, and hopefully our moods will follow.
Wow, circular and gloomy. I'm wondering if I'm going to live up to my reputation as being the cynic in the Capitol newsroom. I guess my one word description would be businesslike. For me, the big question coming out of the 2017 session was, what are we going to see this session in terms of the tension between the internal caucus tension with Republicans? Are we going to continue to see some infighting? Are we going to continue to see what was essentially a negative political campaign that lasted most of the 2017 session? Or were legislators going to focus more on let's get bills through, let's focus on committee work? And I think that's frankly what we've seen the last 3 weeks. There have been a couple of spats, but nothing significant. Folks who were more skeptical of the committee process last year are going through the process this year. They're introducing bills. So for me, the focus is on let's get the business done, and then we can go home and fight.
Well, to argue for circular, I guess one example I'd like to point to is the personal financial disclosure bill. So this is a case where we saw the process play out, I think, in, as Bill said, a very business-like way. An interim committee was convened. It studied campaign finance and took a look at our system. It recommended an array of sweeping changes by unanimous vote, and one of those was to be Idaho's first ever personal financial disclosure requirement for candidates and elected officials in Idaho. And then that committee's unanimous recommendation came before the House State Affairs Committee. It was championed by the committee's chairman, who long had been among the most resistant to this idea. And the committee voted it down. It only got 3 votes. They didn't even agree to introduce it. So where did that leave us? Back where we started.
So we got circular, we got gloomy, we got businesslike. If this session were a tree, I'm guessing it wouldn't be a palm tree on the beach. But I'm not going to ask that question. And I urge you to bring your questions up. If you have questions, you know the drill. If you've been here before, raise up your card. We will find you, and they will bring questions up. But I want to start where we left off at 2017. We had a big fight over taxes. We had the grocery tax veto and the Supreme Court battle. Do you all see any kind of hangover off of that heading into 2018? I mean, Bill, you wrote about the Dirty 30. Well, why don't you pick it up from there?
Well, put me on the spot. All evidence of snark just left my mind, which I... You know, that's a bad start for the pundits forum. So,
but how often do we have a rhyming phrase like that around the Idaho legislature? Dirty 30. I think that's pretty catchy.
We're not even in the limerick season yet. We're already speaking in rhyme. But explain the Dirty 30. Explain that and walk us through that and how that maybe is a backdrop.
So the Dirty 30 is a description of the 30 legislators who signed on to the lawsuit over the summer that challenged the governor's grocery tax veto. And there was, I've heard comments from a number of people that I would characterize more as rumors and speculation rather than definitive evidence that the governor might retaliate against those individuals this session in some form. That the first time I heard about this, the comment was lobbyists are saying, if telling each other that if they've got a bill that they want to get through this session, just make sure that none of those 30 are signed on as co-sponsors because they're toxic. Lawmakers themselves who are part of that group have heard similar rumors. The governor late last week or early this week disinvited four members of leadership to his regular leadership meetings during the session, and then turned around and re-invited them after pushback from the Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem.
Oh my gosh, that sounds almost circular.
Not letting it go, are you? Not letting it go. Continue, Bill.
So there's a question, I guess, about is there going to be retaliation or retribution because of folks who opposed the governor's veto? That remains to be seen. I mean, certainly in the explanation from a number of people on the disinviting the members of leadership was that no, this didn't have anything to do with that. It was an effort at just having a smaller group and more efficient group meeting. So we'll see whether there's any other evidence of the Dirty 30 being toxic. So.
But we still can expect taxes to be, if not a defining issue of this session, maybe the defining issue of the session.
Oh, absolutely. I think taxes and health care, and I thought, you know, ethics and campaign finance, too, were going to be the top issues of this session. And just today, we did see the governor's very major sweeping tax cut bill introduced in the House Revenue and Taxation Committee on a party line vote. And Representative Mike Moyle, the House Majority Leader, said that this is arguably the largest tax cut bill he has seen in all his years in the legislature and possibly in Idaho history. And, you know, for Mike Moyle, that's saying a lot.
But does it go anywhere?
And I think that's going to be the big question, not only if whether that will go anywhere, whether there are going to be competing proposals. And we've already heard of so many other competing proposals, obviously grocery taxes up there. And whether we're going to see a separate grocery tax bill and let the governor's proposal go through untouched, you know, just a clean bill by itself to be judged on its own merits, or whether we're going to see what we did last year, which is people try to tinker with it during some point in the committee process. Or in the Senate, like we saw courtesy of Senator Cliff Bear last year. That has a lot of implications for not just the budgeting process, but also how long we're going to be here. Because remember, after that lawsuit last year, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, we agree with you in theory, people who are saying that the veto wasn't on time, but we're going to say that this goes forward prospectively, right? You need to follow these rules going forward. And not only that, the legislature can't go home until the governor has all of those bills in front of him and he can consider them. So that's going to affect the timeline. That's going to put a lot of uncertainty into the process as far as when people can go home and when people can start introducing stuff.
Just to provide a little more detail on the bill that was introduced this morning, it kind of had two components to it. One was conforming with the federal tax reforms that Congress approved last year, including the doubling of the standard deduction, eliminating the personal exemption. And then the second component of that component, conforming with the federal changes, would actually increase Idaho tax collections by about $97 million. The second component of the bill today would give that money back and more money back in the form of an income tax reduction for both corporations and individuals, plus a new child tax credit of $130 that was an attempt to make up for the loss of the federal dependent exemption. So that's, other than the unemployment insurance bill, that's the first major tax bill of the session. When I talk with folks about is there going to be a grocery tax bill as well as that, or is there going to be an attempt to radiator cap this bill as happened last year, I think the jury's still out on that, but some of the speculation or comments that I've heard is that is this really something we want to get into an internal fight over this year? We've got major gubernatorial candidates in both parties who have all supported eliminating the grocery tax. So a number of people that I've talked to have suggested let's just avoid the fight this year and deal with it when we've got a new governor in place, and maybe we can get the best of both worlds. We can get an income tax reduction this year. We can get a grocery tax elimination next year, and we'll still be friends.
Define friends.
Around here.
So I'm going to shift gears to a question from the floor that I definitely had wanted to get to. So we started the session, the second day of the session, we had workplace training, respectful workplace training that involved not only legislators, but you had lobbyists, reporters invited to it. And it dovetails into a question from the floor about how legislators have responded to Me Too and to the sexual harassment issue. Is it dismissive? Is it cynical? Or is there a serious acknowledgement at the State House?
It depends on what lawmaker you're speaking to. And full disclosure here, I'm the media representative on the Respectful Workplace Committee that was put together by leadership and Senator Sheree Buckner Webb and Representative Carolyn Nelson Troy. And so, as a side note on that, media doesn't often get involved in policy discussions unless it specifically pertains to media access, public records, open government. And this, unfortunately, has become a media access issue for us, and I can get to that later. But since we've had that sexual harassment orientation, I have seen responses from lawmakers all over the place. A lot of people are, quite frankly, cynical and not taking it seriously. There are a lot of people who are much more concerned about false accusations than the original problem in the first place, which is people being harassed, whether it's sexual harassment or harassment, just a hostile workplace environment, right? And so, and there is certainly concern about false accusations, but we risk what I've seen, the pendulum swinging too far the other way. Instead of addressing the root of the problem when it comes to sexual harassment, you know, whether it's against young reporters or young lobbyists or other lawmakers or state house employees or whoever, you would think that the solution to that would be not harassing people and respecting them, but some people have been so concerned about being falsely accused that they're just refusing to meet with young women in the first place. We've heard from my other young female colleagues that there are some lawmakers who will no longer meet with them alone in their office with a closed door, whereas they'll meet with male reporters or male lobbyists by themselves. This has the potential, looking at how many women are in that state house right now in all sorts of different positions, including lawmakers, you're risking solving the problem of harassment and discrimination with another form of discrimination. You're treating people differently simply because of their sex, and it's affecting our access as young women reporters and lobbyists and state house workers and everything like that. So that's it. That's a huge concern for us, and that's why it's unfortunately become a media access issue. We as young women reporters or women reporters or lobbyists or whoever can't be seen as walking, talking liabilities. We're professionals, and we're trying to figure out a way where we can be treated as such and everyone's concerns are met.
We have a couple of questions about the higher education CEO, the governor's proposal to create a chief education officer. I want to go down the table and see what you all think of the prospects of it, and I'll probably chime in myself here.
Well, Kevin, I thought you had a very interesting article today on that topic.
Getting to it, but you go first.
Okay. This proposal comes out of a process in which the governor convened a higher education task force, and we know that his earlier public school improvement task force ended up highly successful. They made a series of far-reaching recommendations that ended up being embraced by all sides. It essentially put an end to the education wars in Idaho and the big schism that occurred after the so-called Luna laws and when reforms were passed by the legislature and then the voters overturned them in a historic move. And instead, we've seen pretty much all sides moving forward arm in arm on several sweeping proposals to improve the schools in Idaho and specifically to improve teacher pay. And so I think the governor was trying to replicate that with his higher education task force here in his final year of his final term. But it's later and it's quicker, and the recommendations perhaps are not as strongly developed and as comprehensive as those that came from the earlier K-12 task force, to the point that this higher ed CEO proposal, which would be a person, a highly paid person, the new highest paid state employee other than university presidents or chief football or basketball coaches, who would be in charge of consolidating back office functions and overseeing those among the state universities, that has become kind of the attention grabber among the proposals, and it's not even actually in the task force recommendations. So the task force called for a leadership structure to allow these consolidations to occur. Seven members of the task force, all top business executives, sent a letter to the governor 2 weeks after the task force concluded its work saying, here's how to do it. Do a CEO. Do this highly paid CEO who can coordinate this and do a consultant study, and we could save millions by better coordinating and consolidating functions among our universities without going to a single university system or a chancellor system, which would be very controversial in a state where we historically have had independent universities. So the recommendations come into the legislature, and at the top of them is basically a high-paid administrative position. Now, how popular is that among legislators looking to, you know, be more efficient and do things better? It is a tough sell, and I think that the governor and the task force have found it to be a tough sell. And at this point, I don't know if it's going to happen.
Everything I know about this, I've learned from you, Kevin, so I would turn the question back on you. What would you say?
So I published a story this morning on idohednews.org about where the current gubernatorial candidates stand on the idea of the CEO, because bear in mind, if the legislature creates this position and funds this position, the next governor is going to inherit this position and this move towards streamlining. I couldn't find a gubernatorial candidate who is sold on the idea. Raul Labrador said that this is an example of growing government. Paulette Jordan called it ill-defined. Brad Little, now mind you, Brad Little is Butch Otter's guy in this campaign. Brad Little says that the idea, this is as close as we get to an endorsement, guys, says the CEO proposal, quote, deserves robust discussion. Now, that is not effusive praise for this proposal, and you've got to also put it in the backdrop of when the State Board went before JFAC last week to present it, members of JFAC asked some fairly pointed but also fairly straightforward questions about how much could you save by doing this and how is the org chart going to look, and those answers were fairly scarce. And then a day later, Bob Custra, when he was asked about it at JFAC, again voiced a lot of skepticism about whether you can really find millions upon millions of dollars of savings within the higher education system. So if I had to guess, and it's a reasonably educated guess from what I feel like I'm seeing so far and hearing so far, I don't think the position, the $200,000 a year position, gets funded. I suspect that you may see there's some one-time money here, up to $500,000 for consulting to try to get a handle on what you could save. And that's one-time money. That's a little bit more of an easy sell sometimes at the legislature. I'm not sure if you get all the way to $500,000, there may be some wiggle room within that. So if I had to guess, you'll get some consulting, just maybe not $500,000 worth. And if you're sharpening your resume because you see yourself as the next higher ed CEO in the state, I would go on LinkedIn and look at other things, because I just don't see that you're going to be a higher ed CEO anytime soon.
Kevin, I tend to think, based on the reaction in the budget committee, if a Democrat had introduced a proposal like this that was so little fleshed out, it wouldn't even get a hearing. I think the budget committee was very skeptical. I think the legislators I've talked to outside of the budget committee are very skeptical. I think what the proposal did do is give legislators an opportunity to talk about the idea of a chancellor system, a unified system for Idaho's higher education institutions. And I think there may be interest in that. And as you indicated, the the consultant may be funded, but it may be funded to look at something beyond what the governor was interested in, not just back office consolidation, but consolidation of the entire system. And are there, does that create opportunities? Does it save money? So the conversation has taken place, but the skepticism about the CEO position is pretty stiff.
The example that was held out to the Budget Committee of another state that has gone through this process successfully was Maine, where they did, you know, a top-to-bottom review and they found tons in savings. The thing is, Maine went to a chancellor system.
Right, and, you know, that, I mean, that's a big difference. I mean, the chancellor has a lot more jurisdiction and a lot more authority over the academic functions than a CEO would have. Worth noting, too, on this process, this is a two-headed process. It's not just JFAC. You would have to have legislation go through the education committees to create this department. We haven't seen that legislation yet. House Education has been a funny and kind of feisty committee so far this year. They've killed a couple of bills. They killed a State Board of Education bill on teacher evaluations, didn't even get it printed. So they're feeling pretty strong in that committee. So I do not think that that would be a slam dunk in that committee at all. For our radio audience, you are listening to the City Club of Boise's annual Political Pundits Forum. We are joined by Betsy Russell and Melissa Davlin and Bill Spence. And I want to shift to a question that's fairly apropos given what we will be listening to later this evening. What, if any, impact has the new federal situation, their words, not mine, federal situation, has had on Idaho's legislature?
Oh, boy. It's quite a
wide-reaching
question. As far as the legislature goes, I'm not sure if this is specifically a product of President Trump's tumultuous relationship with the media, or if this is part of a larger issue that helped get President Trump into the White House in the first place. We've noticed it on the media side. There's a lot more animosity toward the media, and that's been noticeable. There has also been some uncertainty. We had a great interview with the Joint Appropriations and Finance Committee co-chairs on Idaho Reports last week, Maxine Bell and Sean Keough, and they said that there's some uncertainty surrounding some of the federal funds that Idaho uses for programs which they partner with the federal government for, you know, so healthcare, transportation, whether or not that will continue. Idaho Reports has also been traveling the state and talking to a lot of communities who are pretty excited about the idea that Trump will get rid of some of the regulations that they saw as burdensome for development or mining or other things that the community is really dependent upon. So it's been mixed. There's some excitement. There's some uncertainty. We still see uncertainty surrounding healthcare and what the federal government's going to do after failing to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but getting rid of the individual mandate, how that's going to affect healthcare. So it's not that that uncertainty is a bad thing. It's just that this level of excitement in that you would think would happen in a Republican state with a Republican-controlled Congress and also a Republican in the White House, it's tempered with people not being sure what's going on and it affecting Idaho policy.
I'm thinking of two examples. One has to do with what Melissa mentioned about attitudes toward the media. This year in the Idaho legislature, we have seen a bill introduced to end the publication of legal notices in newspapers with the argument that nobody reads newspapers anymore, the government can just put it on their own website. Well, this bill could be the death knell to small community newspapers throughout the state of Idaho. It's a significant institution in our state, and actually that is the one segment of the newspaper industry that is not losing readership. And in fact, newspapers have lots of people reading them. They're just reading them in different ways now, including online. And if the government is the only one in control of putting out important public notices to people, and and no other institution has any say, do we really trust what the government's putting out? And these questions, I mean, this bill I don't think would have been introduced before now. But to hear it be introduced and taken seriously and people talking about how, who needs newspapers? I don't think that's something we would have seen in the past. And I think that President Trump has a lot to do with that. This other one is kind of a small example. I think this was just yesterday in JFAC, where they were talking about the expanded access program through which 34 Idaho kids are receiving, through a drug trial, a form of CBD oil, a commercial product that otherwise they could not have in the state because it's not legal. And it was anticipated that that commercial product, which is made by a big pharmaceutical company out of Britain, would probably be FDA approved by now and would be on the market, and there would be no need for this kind of program. Well, what we found out was that due to all the uncertainty at the federal level, that has not yet happened. And so the Otter administration is asking for another year of funding for that, to get those 34 kids through another year, because who knows when the FDA will approve that.
Kevin, I think other than federal tax reform, the other major impact from the Trump administration, which Melissa touched on, is health care. The governor has talked about the two waiver proposals that he's hoping to submit. He's talked about his executive order to try to come up with new state-based health insurance plans that are 30% to 50% cheaper than ACA plans. I don't think any of those proposals would even have come forward if there had not been a change in the administration and party at the federal level. The healthcare, state-based healthcare plans specifically would not have moved forward prior to Congress eliminating the individual mandate. Those are, tax conformity and healthcare, those are two major impacts from that relate directly to the federal administration.
But there's still uncertainty surrounding that, because we're not sure, even if the federal government is interested in getting rid of regulations, even if this administration has made it clear that they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, they still have to sign off on not just the health care proposal on the Medicaid dual waivers, but also the executive order that Governor Otter and Lieutenant Governor Little signed in January. And so that uncertainty still exists, and that dependency and that tension still exists. It's just a little bit different now.
Well, let's stay there. I mean, let's kind of, close the loop on this circular topic of health care at the State House. I mean, the governor and the lieutenant governor launched the session unveiling this executive order to try to resolve this issue, in their view, and stamp out Obamacare in the state for once and for all. How does this thing end up this session?
So let's start with the executive order, because that has actually been signed. The director of insurance, Dean Cameron, who has a pretty tough task in front of him with trying to create guidelines for these insurance products that then depend on insurance companies wanting to create plans that fit those parameters. And honestly, if the federal government goes ahead and enforces their interpretation of the Affordable Care Act, if it's, these aren't compliant and we need them to comply while this law is still on the books, those insurance carriers risk getting fined while those insurance plans are available to customers. And so there are still a lot of hurdles for this plan to get into the marketplace. That just requires the federal government to not enforce its own law on plans being available that comply with the Affordable Care Act. There's a lot going on there. There are a lot of hurdles. There are a lot of insurance companies who might not want to take that risk. With the dual waiver, we've seen a lot of concerns from lawmakers, and even though a new plan was introduced this morning with a few more sideboards on it, and Betsy was there and has those details, that also requires the federal government to sign off on those waivers. And there's no guarantee that they're going to do that. The Otter administration and lawmakers have been in touch with the federal government trying to see if they will be okay with that proposal. There are no promises yet. It sounds not exactly promising, but it's not doomed from what I've heard, speaking to Director Cameron, but that uncertainty is there again.
It's really interesting reading the national news reports about the executive order and what Idaho's trying to do, and then talking to Director Cameron, because it's just night and day. I mean, pretty much, I'm hearing on the national news that Idaho has marched off and done something crazy and obviously illegal, and not only are they going to get shut down, they're probably going to get sued. And Dean Cameron, who really knows his stuff over there at the Department of Insurance, says that's not true at all. He thinks that we're entirely within our legal authority in the way that he is setting up these guidelines. And I think a lot of the rumors about what these, you know, they were deemed skinny plans, what these state-based insurance plans would be prior to the guidance coming out, were that, oh, well, they're not going to offer a bunch of benefits. And it didn't help prior to the legislative session when reporters at the AP preview asked Governor Otter, well, what's an example of what might not be offered? And he said, well, why should I have to pay for maternity coverage? Well, it turns out maternity coverage is still in there. It has to be in at least one of the plans that one of these carriers offering one of these would have, along with all the other basic categories of essential benefits. Instead, the way that Director Cameron has set this up, the way that they save money and have rates be much lower is by doing a bunch of other things, including bringing back the pre-existing condition exclusion for those who are not continuously insured 63 days before they enroll, doing some more age rating, which could hurt you if you're older, doing things like offering cheaper rates to people who are healthier. And so when I asked Director Cameron, well, you know, doesn't that hurt someone who's old? He said yes, and so or someone with a pre-existing condition, so they would not enroll in that plan. And the carriers who are offering these plans would have to offer both an ACA-compliant plan and one of these new state-based plans, and they will be pooled together in the same pool. So the idea is to bring healthy people back into the pool, increase the pool, and lower costs. It sounds really intriguing. Is it illegal? Are we going to get sued? I don't think we know, but Dean Cameron doesn't think so.
And an important note about Dean Cameron is when he was in the Idaho Senate he was working on the state-based insurance exchange, he went toe-to-toe with the Obama administration and Health and Human Services in that capacity and said, this is what's working for Idaho. We want to toe that line. So he knows insurance, and he knows how to work with the federal government. He's done this before, albeit in a different capacity. And so, not saying that it can be done, but I think if anyone could do it, it would probably be Director Cameron.
And one other point about whether or not insurers are going to want to do this. I've read a lot of news reports saying insurers aren't going to want to do this. But Blue Cross of Idaho, the largest insurer that offers plans on the Idaho Exchange, sent out a statement last week, a day after the guidance came out, from their CEO, basically welcoming this and saying they were going to look at trying to offer something.
But did any other insurance companies?
No, not yet. And I did ask Director Cameron about that, and he said typically Blue Cross goes first. And then we hear from Regents, and then we hear from PacifiCorp, and that's kind of how things work.
So, Betsy, I hope you thanked him for not using the phrase fake news. But I think, as Melissa was indicating, to me, that's one of the important things that people should not ignore about all of these proposals is they're innovative. I mean, the way the two waivers work together is very creative. The executive order and what they're coming up with on state-based plans, it's very creative. You've got a director of the Department of Insurance who has industry experience, who has budget experience as a JFAC co-chair and experience with the legislator. You've got a governor and lieutenant governor who want an Idaho-based solution to this issue and who want a solution to the issue, who want to address the plight of the Medicaid gap population. So I'm not familiar enough with what's going on in other states to know if they're accurate in this, but what they have said, what the governor and lieutenant governor have said and the director of the Department of Insurance have said is that Idaho is pushing the envelope on this, that other states haven't come up with this kind of creative idea. And I think that's an important aspect of this that shouldn't be overlooked. So if you want to pass that snark jar down here, if I'm going to have to defend him, I want to get paid for it. So you know, I'm actually taking some money out of it. So thank you.
I feel
so
like
for the benefit of our radio audience, what you did not
in.
See was a blatant raid upon the snark jar by Bill Spence.
Fine.
Unprecedented in the history of the snark jar. Okay. All right. Justice has been done and order has been restored. This is an interesting question from the audience, and it dovetails into something that we haven't heard very much during this session. We didn't hear it in the State of the State, but it's very definitely an issue at the federal level, and that's infrastructure funding. What do you see as the prospects of the state addressing infrastructure funding in light of the likelihood that the federal government is going to put more money into infrastructure?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Governor Otter said about roads in his State of the State message this year, he didn't.
I just want to jump in real quick and point out that Governor Otter started his tenure as governor where infrastructure it was his main issue, and now at the end of his tenure, education is his main issue. So for those of you who are looking at the federal level and President Trump's push for infrastructure funding, you should expect him to gradually shift to becoming the education president pretty soon here. So if he follows Butch Otter's path. There you go. You can have that back. So.
Okay, well, now we're starting to get some money flowing. That's a good thing. Another education topic, and this will come up this week, is the ongoing debate over science standards. What do you see as the prospects of the science standards issue getting resolved this time around? It's the third year we've been talking about it or writing about it.
I don't have the inside line on where that's going, but I do know how it plays statewide and how it plays nationally. And I do think that once again, when we have our big hearing about whether or not five sections relating to climate change should be included in our school science standards next year, we're going to get national attention, and people are going to be asking themselves, what are they doing in Idaho?
As you were saying on the way over, Education Week is going to be here this week to cover these hearings.
And the PBS NewsHour.
So.
You know what's great about public television? Even if Idaho doesn't pass these standards, we have some really great science programming. Science Trek by Joan Carton Hansen, local production, PBS NewsHour, all of these great
shows.
Okay,
then that's not snark, but that's an in-kind contribution,
I just,
Melissa.
Just fact-based, non-partisan.
Okay, they really are good
right,
shows.
Right.
It's great.
Okay. That's what we like to see. And one aside on this whole science standards debate, and it's worth watching, Sherry Ibarra, in her budget request, there is a line item for a new science assessment. That is part of her plan for assessments. You may be trying to put together a science assessment with science standards still in limbo, depending on what happens in these committees. So that would be interesting. So we're about 15 minutes away, and we really haven't asked any questions about politics and elections, so I'm going to segue into that.
Wait, I thought that was a good thing.
I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. So, questioner asked the question that I think is on a lot of people's minds. How do you see the Republican primary for governor playing itself out between now and May 15th? Other than a debate that may or may not go viral.
Kevin. I think that if anyone at this point tells you that they know exactly how that Republican gubernatorial primary is going to turn out, they are either lying to you or themselves. It is a fascinating race. There are three very, very different candidates and campaigns. I know a lot of people like to say that Tommy Ahlquist and Lieutenant Governor Little are pretty similar, but when you look at their experience and some of their proposals, there are some really interesting differences there. And so I would not bet money on how that's going to turn out. I will say I think it's going to get uglier. Right now it's been pretty amicable, which is nice. And I appreciate, but I'm afraid that that time for civility is limited, unfortunately.
I think the other issue is that the positions have been pretty well staked out from as soon as people declared for office. You knew that Lieutenant Governor Little was basically going to be the status quo candidate. You knew that Raul Labrador was going to be a change candidate. You knew that Tommy Ahlquist was positioning himself as the outsider candidate. And I think those three perspectives are reasonably accurate. And then it comes down to the voters themselves. Are they happy with the status quo? Do they want somebody who's going to be tougher on budget growth than we've seen over the last 12 years or at least the last 6 years? And how do they feel about an outsider candidate? So the choices have been pretty clear from as soon as the candidates themselves entered the race.
I agree with everything that's been said. I think it's a fabulous race. It's going to be extremely entertaining, and I'm looking forward to that debate. That's going to be quite a debate. These are three very strong, very different front runners for governor in the Republican primary. And then we also have a contested primary on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask.
One of those candidates, Representative Paulette Jordan from Plummer, is, you know, right there in the legislature and is casting votes and making statements right now that play into and draw attention to her run for governor. We've got actually candidates in both houses who are running for lieutenant governor and Congress. I mean, the elections in some ways are playing out within the halls of the Capitol this year as well as outside.
Well, and let's stay there for a second, because this is unusual, but it's also very interesting. We have a fairly high-profile Democratic primary for governor. How does that play itself out? And aside from you have to moderate another debate, that may or may not go viral.
It plays out in more stress for me. let's hope that one doesn't go viral. The entry of Paulette Jordan into this race is fascinating, And as you mentioned, there are some really interesting votes and stances that she's already taken. And not a lot's happened policy-wise in the legislature, but this week she voted in the State Affairs Committee to introduce Stand Your Ground legislation. There was only one vote against doing that, but she voted with Republicans. Now, I monitor a lot of political groups on Facebook, you know, all across the spectrum, and there were a lot of progressive Idahoans and Democrats who were really concerned and alarmed about the introduction of this bill and Paulette Jordan's vote on it. A lot of people wrote to her about it, and some posted Representative Jordan's response, that she said that she was against the bill, but she wanted to vote for it because a lot of her constituents are in favor of it, and she thought that that was a really interesting policy discussion to have, you know, play out in public. So I don't remember her doing this in past legislative sessions. And I am wondering if we're going to see more of that. I think we probably will. That's not a value commentary on whether or not that's a good idea to do, but it's certainly a shift in what I seem to remember from Representative Jordan.
And there was also another notable vote in the past week in which Representative Jordan broke from her party and, in fact, voted with 9 so-called liberty legislators in a challenge to Speaker Behnke's leadership with regard to whether personal bills get hearings in germane committees or go to Ways and Means, as has been the custom for a long time. And Representative Jordan voted with 9 Republicans on that.
And I don't know if anyone is scrutinizing A.J. Belukoff's votes on the Boise School District Board, but you know, maybe we should. But Paulette Jordan is a really interesting candidate for a number of reasons. She's from North Idaho. She's a woman. She's a woman of color. She would be the first American Indian governor if she were to get through the gauntlet of primary and general election. And so it's a fascinating race. And then A.J. Belukoff is also an interesting factor. He has one campaign under his belt. So presumably more experience. He doesn't have to work as hard at name recognition. And so I wonder if that's going to change the dynamic of that race moving forward, if maybe we might see more risks from him.
But I'll tie this into another question from the audience. Do you see any hope for Democrats to pick up any seats or positions in this next election cycle?
Hope implies we're rooting for them. The midterms are always so interesting, and there's a long time between now and November. I think that obviously there's a chance. You know, there are some really interesting dynamics playing out as a lot of people are leaving the legislature to run for higher office or just retirements in general. So I wouldn't put any money on anything.
I think that, you know, the Democrats' electoral record in Idaho in recent years has been abysmal. But the Democrats have been newly energized, not just in Idaho, but nationwide under the Trump administration. And the Indivisible movement is active in Idaho. There are new candidates stepping forward and announcing that they're running for things like the legislature. There were candidates announcing at women's marches. So who knows? Maybe the Democrats will take a different approach in this year's elections.
And at the same time, I find myself very interested and fascinated and perplexed as I watch the race for state superintendent. Now, this is the last state election that the Democrats won. They came very close to winning in 2014. Jenna Jones came within a few thousand votes of winning that election. We've not seen a Democrat announce for that race, and here we are almost to February. And you have this bizarrely low-key race. I mean, we've got sunshine reports that are due this week, and I'm watching those. Sherry Ibarra, who's never been much of a fundraiser, never been much of what you would call an aggressive campaigner, $3,000 was all she raised the second half of 2017, and she accounts for $2,000 of it. So this is not a race that is exactly, you know, taking shape at this point, and right now it's a race between her and Jeff Dillon, who is not very well known statewide. He's a superintendent in Wilder, in rural Canyon County. So I remain baffled about that race.
Kevin, I'm not that familiar with the state superintendent race, but as far as the question on Democrats, look, up until November, the Democrats on a statewide race and the federal races, I don't know that I could have named a Democrat other than Troy Minton, who was the Boise homeless advocate. So they were not present on the statewide level until AJ got into the race and then Paulette got into the race. And other than those two and Troy Minton, I'm still not able to name very many Democratic candidates at state or federal races. And the only other race that comes to mind where a Democrat might have an opportunity is up in my area in District 5, where Senator Dan Forman has been, he's kind of the poster boy for legislators who would rather pick their words more carefully so that they're not hammered in the next election versus a legislator who tells you exactly what he's thinking and why he's thinking and doesn't care about the political consequences of that. Because Dan is very outspoken in his views of things, he's probably going to be a target for, in fact, the Democrat has already entered that race and has a chance of picking up that seat. But that's the only race that I can think of, to be blunt, where I see Democrats having a chance.
So this question came with a dollar attached, so I'll read it as follows, and I'll kind of broaden it out because I think there's a good question here as we watch the session unfold. Questioner asks, will this be the year we are saved from Sharia law? You got your money's worth with that one. But we do have, we have that bill, which is coming back. We have an abortion bill. We have a various menu of hot-button issues, social issues that have already surfaced, and maybe more on the way. Do any of these have any greater prospect than others of seeing their way through the process?
Well, the anti-Sharia bill I do not think will pass. This is the third year it's been proposed. Representative Eric Redman feels very strongly about proposing it, and this is his final year in the legislature, and I think that in respect for him, his colleagues agreed to introduce it again, but that perhaps there are concerns about the bill. But there are many, many bills on many, many hot-button issues being introduced this year. I think, a lot more than usual, and being introduced in committee, not just as personal bills. And part of that seems to be a part of a rapprochement between the so-called Liberty Caucus and the House Republican leadership. So more of these ideas are coming out into the light and being scrutinized, and that's probably a good thing. I don't know that that means that they will pass. However, with regard to the anti-abortion legislation, traditionally in Idaho, a very Republican-dominated state, anti-abortion legislation will be proposed in an election year, and it will pass regardless of what it's about.
Another interesting factor in that is Senator Bart Davis, the majority leader, is no longer in the Senate. He was appointed to be Idaho's U.S. District Attorney. Senator Davis was often very good at persuading colleagues, whether in public or in caucus meetings, about maybe we shouldn't, you don't want to do this, I understand where you're coming from, but this is not constitutional and here's why. And that is nothing, to say nothing about the new Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Winder, or anybody else in Senate leadership and their views or their ability to do so. I'm wondering if that's going to be a factor in what we see get through the Senate compared to years past.
Well, one of Bill's legislators just introduced a bill this morning set up a process by which Idaho legislators could nullify U.S. Supreme Court decisions and federal laws. Bill, did you want to comment on that one?
We're just sticking up for North Central Idaho. You know? I guess for me, a legislative session is always this constant back and forth between rosy optimism and just the darkest cynicism about humanity. And this is an area where I think the public tends to be cynical, that hey, it's an election year, you're going to see all sorts of partisan bills and pressure to vote for things that you wouldn't otherwise do. And I don't know that I have seen that. I mean, this is my 10th session, and legislation that passes in a non-election year versus an election year, I don't know that I can say, okay, here's an obvious difference between the two. So when you see bills come up this session, for example, the bill that Betsy just referenced, it came up last year, it was introduced, didn't get a hearing. I frankly don't expect any different reaction this year other than it might get a hearing, but if legislation doesn't have a chance in a non-election year, I wouldn't really expect it to have much of a chance in an election year. I just don't see legislators work on bills that they believe in, and they're willing to come forward with them anytime somebody gives them an opportunity to come forward. Not whether it's an election year or not isn't that big a factor, I think.
Thank you all for spending your time with us on this panel, and thank you all for being here.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise and its 23rd annual Political Pundits Forum, featuring Bill Spence, Melissa Davlin, Betsy Russell, and moderator Kevin Richard. The next City Club Forum is on Wednesday, February 21st, and will feature a panel discussing the opioid crisis in the U.S. and specifically here in Idaho. Register for that lunch forum, find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org. You can connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.